to the Alton Brown Cast once again, recording from my fabulous, luxurious trailer on the lot at Cutthroat Kitchen, someplace hidden in Burbank, California. And my guest today, we've been trying to work this out for quite a while. This guy's one of the judges on the show, and actually I think we met. I mean, we had met before, but we
loosely met actually on the set of Iron Chef America.
Of Iron Chef America,
yeah, but it was
a while back.
It was three years ago.
Anyway, I have Jett Tila with me, who I have a great deal of respect for, and we've been talking about having this interview for a while. Not just because of Cutthroat Kitchen, but just because I'll be really honest. I want your story, because you've gone, and I know that you've probably given it 6,000 times. So, give me the version, because I've read about you. You know, I've done my research about you, but there's a lot missing, and there's a lot that smacks of PR, my friend, and a kind of corporate spank. So, I want the straight story, man.
Okay,
I want
no
the Jett Tila story.
Yeah, of course. You know. It started like about 40 years ago here in Alhambra, California, a little what's turned out to be a Chinese suburb of Los Angeles, right? But back then in the 70s, it was actually a Mexican neighborhood, right? I don't know, man. Like, you know, again, like you need to help me, because again, when you work in this industry for so long and you have to kind of wear the goggles of PR sometimes, wear the goggles of the corporate world sometimes. You know, that story becomes almost like, you know, which one was the reality? So, like, and it's all real, but there's always like that corporate
spin.
Version.
It's spin. That's what it really is. Because you become a brand at some point.
That's it. Exactly. And you know, I still feel like we're like a demi brand. I think, you know, I think we've done really well kind of in business and restaurants and markets and stuff like that. But what's the story? The bottom line, at the end of the day, you know, I think, you know, I was really, 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 really lucky to be born into, I call them the first family of Thai food. At the end of my mom and dad started the first, they were the first people to sell any food products that are Thai in America, right? They were the first people to start a market that was a Thai market. They were in that first generation of Thai people that came in the 60s, mm-hmm. right? This first kind of mass young people immigration in 66. And you know, my dad was like a street kid from Thailand, like the real deal, like literal, like the $400 in his pocket. A really rich friend of his had a sponsor's ticket over, because he was a rich kid, wanted to go to college, but he was scared and he wanted, you know, someone to kind of look out for him. And that was my dad's role. So, Jesus, like, again, it's such a long, sordid, weird story. Like, where are the good bits of it? I mean, it's
well, you became a cook.
I did.
Because you were in the family business.
Yes, exactly. And it wasn't romantic. It was like my family opened their first restaurant in 78. Right. And I was born in 75, so I was 3 years old. We opened a market in 72. So this is pre-birth, right?
Got it.
In Thailand, going back, my grandma actually had a little, you know what a real shop house is? There's you live upstairs, you work downstairs, you live on the second and third. And the first floor was a little Chinese coffee shop. So my family, ethnically, I'm Chinese. I came from this little place called Hainan Island, right? It's like the Hawaii of China. And we had
I didn't know China had a Hawaii.
Yeah, it's actually pretty really awesome. Beautiful, man. It's like we're island people. Other fun things about Hainanese people is during like the Singapore Raffles era, anyone who worked in a kitchen in Singapore had to be of Hainanese Chinese descent specifically.
Why?
No one else was allowed because they probably were the first group of laborers, right? The first cooks, the first maids, the first, you know, any of that, the lowest rung of service industry hotel folk was probably brought in as Chinese Hainanese people. And there's a tie to Hainanese and straight Chinese, like the Hakka, you know, the Nonya people, the Nonyas. Anyway, so the Chinese went, they were brought into Singapore, right? And then, you know, the straits, like the Straits of Malacca there.
Malacca,
so
sure.
they left the hotel business and then started to settle. So, but they were Chinese and now they were in Southeast Asia. And then this kind of this Nonya cuisine came up from all these Chinese. So anyway, that was my ethnic origin. That's the only reason I even tell that story. That's my ethnic origin. How do I get to L.A., right?
Well, we know how you got to L.A. Your parents came here.
Exactly.
They immigrated in the 60s.
Yeah.
Now, that was during the height of the Vietnam War.
The Vietnam
War. Were they getting just a lot of Dodge, or did they actually want to come to America specifically as a did they want to come to America specifically because they had this dream?
So I think the Vietnam War connection is, you know, Thailand was always a close ally with the U.S., so visas were easy, right, for the Thais, right? Yeah. So they were just basically...
Still are, I
assume. They really are. Yeah. No extradition, there's all the good relationships, the whole deal. But anyway, so they came in and, you know, they didn't try to get away from war, they were just looking for opportunity, right? And so my dad was the first to kind of start like, well, hey, Alton's coming. Like, you knew specifically who was coming from Thailand at that point, right? Who was coming back and forth. So
everybody.
Like everyone. Okay. Like, you're right. You knew everyone. So like the Italian communities in America early on, you knew like if Alton was coming in, he should bring like a case of coconut milk with him. And then if Jet was coming, he should bring fish sauce. So we started this little trading post. Right, of Asian
expats, basically.
Yeah, exactly.
Thai expats.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And then that's how the Bangkok market started in 72. So,
where is it? How long did it last?
It still exists today. It's still there. So it's on Melrose Avenue in East Hollywood in L.A. My mom's still there 3-4 days a week. It's 40 something years old. So that's how I really started, man. I was a cook because, you know what, I was forced to be. I had no choice, right? It wasn't romantic, right? I worked in the family's
market. Get in the kitchen.
Exactly. Come home from school. You know that kid that sits in the corner doing their homework in the Asian restaurant that you walk into? I was that kid for forever. And summers were spent either in the markets or the restaurants. So I grew up in the business. And then around the 80s, I also opened an import company. So I did, you know, cracked open trucks and then unloaded them. And then late in the 80s, they started growing Asian produce in Mexico. Because most of the Asian produce, during wintertime and summertime, right? During the winter, it's too cold to grow in Central Valley. So my dad was like, let's smuggle a bunch of these seeds into Mexico. Let's grow gailan, bok choy, bitter melon, all that stuff in Mexico. So he started that industry. He spent a considerable amount of the 80s and early 90s in Mexico, and we'd go back and forth. So I've seen every angle of the Asian food business, you know. I mean, so it's really just been blessed to grow up in it.
At what point did you start to realize that you had your own ambitions, not just a family extension?
I think it was in probably my 20s, dropped out of high school. And
why'd you do that?
School was always tough for me. Like, I was always, you know.
And you're obviously a bright guy, so.
I think I wasn't stimulated or, you know, just something about school. I just couldn't adhere to the confines of a structured learning establishment, right? I couldn't do it, right? I think I was learning things, but I couldn't do my homework and I couldn't study and I couldn't do any of that. So my senior year, I was like, screw it. I'm going to get my GED before all these kids graduate. So I went and I just finished. I mean, they sent me to private school, but I got my GED instead. And I was like, I'm out of here, man. And so that was around, I was always working in the family business.
Well, was there pressure? I'm just curious because of the academic kind of thing that I know of in Asian families. Did you get a lot of flack? Did you have a tiger mom or a tiger grandmom who was like all up in your business about the GED thing?
I had, my dad has six brothers, so the seven Tila boys were here. His mom, so the matriarch on that side, the matriarch on my dad's side. I had tiger everything. But, you know, I always had this, you know, like, I don't know what I'm going to do with myself, but I'll be something, you know? And so it was really hard from the family side. I mean, from my mom would cry, like, you know, every time there would be,
you
know.
Oh, mom, don't cry.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, yeah, I had.
Mine still does.
She cries tears of joy. My mom finally flipped a few years ago, but. I'm sorry, I'm going all over the place.
No. Yeah. This is how it happens.
Oh, yeah, I got you, man. It was really hard growing up. I mean, through my teens and early 20s, like, I was the one who's pegged to be nothing, so it was just easy. So I was like, I'm out then. Like, I don't want nothing to do with you.
Nobody
guys.
Expected anything from you.
Zero. They expected me to actually create trouble. So it wasn't even like it was a negative, not a wash at that point for them. They thought I would bring back problems to the family, et cetera.
And what changed that? Was there one thing or a particular time where everybody all of a sudden realized, oh, Jet's going to be okay?
I think it started before. The time I think the family felt by that time is when I got my first executive chef position. So I was 33. I cooked a tasting at Wynn. That was the pivotal moment for them. For me, it started way earlier than that, right? But for me, it started when... around my early 20s, I started teaching cooking classes out of my mom's backyard because I always cooked. Like, through all this, you know, pity party story. I cooked through my teens professionally. I cooked through family gatherings and when my friends would come over, I would cook. So I cooked, you know, and I had no idea that I had all this food knowledge. just kind of through from experience.
Because you just soaked it up.
I've been cooking since I was like 13, right? I mean, like in a profession, in a restaurant, in my family's restaurant. So around I think it was like 98 or 97, I started these cooking classes because there was Food Network was still brand new, if not, you know what I mean? And I would set up these little rented four top tables with an 8-foot workstation, 2 cartridge burners, and I wrote these little three dishes, like learn pad thai, Penang curry, and satay, right? So it would be cycled like an app, a light dish, and a main dish, right? So I wrote like these series of 6 or 7 cooking classes. And there's a woman named Barbara Hansen, and she wrote about ethnic cuisine for the LA Times for the last 30 years, right? So she somehow snuck it, like heard about this and snuck into my class because she shopped at our market, and I would put flyers up at the market. And I get a call from the LA Times and like, oh, we're going to send a photographer out to shoot. I'm like, what happened? What are you talking about? Well, Barbara Hansen, who was in your class, wants to write about you. I was like, this is nuts, man. So, you know, you don't think much about it.
You didn't even realize that she had been in the class.
I know. Okay. I had no idea. So until they called me, the photographers mm-hmm. coming mm-hmm. in. And then I was like, cool. You think you'd get like maybe a 16th of a page buried somewhere horrible in the food section. And it was a front page story that year. It was that cover of the LA Times food section. And I literally got 1,000 phone calls that week. And saying,
what was it like when you first, I want to go back when you saw it, because you didn't know.
No.
You thought it was going to be buried under some coupons.
Yes.
And then you get the paper, either you go to the newsstand or it's delivered to your house.
Yeah.
And you open it.
Yeah.
And describe, I want to know what that felt like.
It's like the feeling. The first thing I wanted to do was like take it to my family and like put it in their face. It was, you know, it was validation. That, I mean, you know, I'm trying to find the words, but it really was
validation.
It was that pivotal moment where like, I think I have found my path on top of being really excited that something I've done was recognized. But that clearly was the moment I knew I needed to go to culinary school. I needed to formalize my education because from that point I was speaking from, you know, a mom and pop restaurant operator, right? My teaching, my words.
No authority. You're not going to have authority that way.
And I think that the food language, that cookbook language and TV food language is spoken through the translation of French cuisine, right? Because it's something that I think we're most used to.
If you don't have that, you're not considered to be well-rounded. You're not, you're just not real.
Right. Don't you feel that way?
No, it's absolutely true. If you don't have some French, you don't have the cred.
And if you can say like, you know, these things are the mirepoix of Thailand, all of a sudden, like like when you say things like that, it just makes sense.
Yep.
Right.
Yep.
So,
it's the common language of food worldwide. Really.
That's it.
And if you don't speak it, you can't really be part of that community.
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
So that was that moment when I saw, and that week when I got all these phone calls, I knew there was a need. I knew that I had, a niche. I knew that I had a talent, like a direction. I had zero direction until then. I was doing cooking classes to like, you know, to score beer money and have some cash in my pocket.
I'm still doing that.
Well, aren't we all doing that at the end of the day? Bourbon money, though. Beer money becomes bourbon money.
You know, it depends on what time of year, you know. I'll still work for beer, but bourbon's a little better, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you know, one day I'd like to flip it and interview you because, I mean, that would be ultimate for me.
Well, yeah. Go ahead and ask.
Oh, really?
That's nothing that interesting.
But you know, what was your pivotal moment, though? I mean, it had to be what prompted you to do Good Eats?
That came out of disgust, in a way. I was directing TV commercials, and had been in filmmaking my entire professional life. And one day, I just was so sick of the clients that I had that I remember sitting down at my desk, and I actually still think I have this someplace. I wrote down on a piece of paper, Julia Child, Mr. Wizard, Monty Python.
Wow.
If you even remember Mr. Wizard. Science show, of course. Yes. And my whole thing was, you know what? I bet you could put those three things together in a TV show, because I cooked as a hobby. It was my release. You know, I started cooking in college to get girls.
Right, right. Which works, right?
Works awesome. And you can get away a lot cheaper. Yeah. And if you plan your meals properly, you have leftovers to make something for breakfast, which I actually never actually got to pull off. But that's when I started cooking. And then I cooked just as a hobby, because it was something to do that wasn't anything having to do with work. And then I became kind of obsessed, and then decided to quit and go to culinary school. But it didn't happen in one moment. It happened over about a year where I couldn't get this thought out of my mind, this idea that, you know what, I really want to make films about something I care about, and I'm really passionate about food. So that's what I want to do. And of course, everybody said, "You're insane. You're a madman.
There was no benchmark at that time. There was
nothing.
You know what I mean?
You're simply insane, and you're going to throw away your career, and you're going to throw away your life. And I guess I'm still throwing it away.
Get out.
I just can't find the dumpster.
This self-effacing stuff is crazy, man. Like, you know, I mean, to the world, it's like, you know, you're a true pioneer, though. I mean, honestly.
Well, I would like to think. It's funny. The driving thing for me was some people want to be really good.
Yeah.
Some people want to be original. I would rather be original than good.
Got it.
I would rather do something that nobody's done before and have it be, okay, at least it's never existed before. And that was, if I had a driving kind of mission, it was to do something new.
But you, at the core, look, I feel like you like to educate. Mm-hmm. You like to entertain.
I don't believe that you can educate without entertaining.
Got it.
Personally.
Okay.
And I think it's like, I barely graduated from high school.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, barely.
Really?
I mean, like, I practically had to give the principal $20 for a diploma. And I'm not even sure it had my name on it. I think it was somebody who was like a dead person's diploma. No, horrible student. Horrible student.
Why do you think that?
Oh, bored. It made no sense. I didn't know why I was doing it. You know, it's funny. I've often said that, you know, what you need, you want to teach a biology class, cut up a chicken, not some formaldehyde soaked fetal pig. You know,
right.
It's like, you know, in cutting up and cooking one chicken, I can teach seven different sciences at once and we'll eat.
Right.
But nothing had an end result. Nothing. It was like, no one was able to draw a line. If you do this, then this, then this. There was no path. It was just a drudgery.
Right.
And the only reason I probably ended up not dying was that I played saxophone in the jazz band and became obsessed with jazz. And so that was my cultural thing at that point.
But there's this clear like love of science involved in how you teach cooking, though.
It wasn't because I loved science originally.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I was terrible in science. Yeah. I flunked chemistry. I flunked biology. But the thing is that I like knowing why stuff works. And I think that if you can give people the understanding of why something happens, then they own it.
Yes.
You know, and that's one of the things about, like, French cuisine. A lot of people trained in classic French kitchen. We don't own it because we're simply doing by rote what we've been told to do by the chef. We chef. Never pourquoi. Never why.
Yes, right. Right.
It is not for us to question. We do. And half of the time, you know, you ask a really great French chef why water boils. They don't know.
Yeah.
They don't care.
Yeah.
That's understanding doesn't mean anything. But in this day and age, in media and in this country, where we have so much access to so much food and so many, you know, cultural influences, my thing is if you can understand why the egg cooks, then you can make the egg better.
Mm-hmm.
And then you'll understand, if the egg cooks this way, guess what? That's why a souffle does this. And that's why an omelet does that. And that's why a cake does this. And that's why...
It's
so to me, it's just a matter of giving people some power. Power to the people, man.
Right. So you was it a sizzle, or did you do a, for a Good Eats? Was it a treat? Was a
two log full line, tell episodes?
Me. Oh, you shot two full episodes
on film.
What?
We didn't know anything about video.
Oh,
we
hadn't
shot video because we shot commercials and we did them all on film.
You did all film.
So we actually, the first two episodes of Good Eats, a show called Stake Your Claim, which is about cooking one steak, a ribeye, and This Spud's for You, which is about potatoes, still airs on Cooking Channel to this day. And people look and say, well, that looks kind of weird. And I'm like, that's because it was shot on film.
That's awesome.
And, you know, I had a full head of hair and was a little chubby kind of guy. This became a me interview. What just happened here?
See,
you just turned it.
This is one of my passions. Anyway, okay, let's flip it back.
But, okay.
Yeah.
How did you end up in Vegas?
Mm.
Because you kind of sidestepped that.
I had a really weird. You know how you often feel like a fraud, right? In many ways, right? I think a lot of us I think people will look at us and go, "Wow, you've accomplished so much." I always feel like, dude, I've always taken the accelerated course in everything. So I was a line cook for. Look, this is being brutal now and honest, right? I was a line cook in a fine dining restaurant for maybe 6 months to a year. Right. And then I went off. So here's my weird path. Around the early 90s, so the whole tech sector was just booming, right?
Exploding, yeah.
Incredibly exploding. And there's a company that called Bon Appetit Management. And
I know Bon Appetit.
Oh, sure. Because you know, absolutely. you did the Google thing. They had all these Asian engineers. They had a bunch of Asian, you know, the startup kings, like the execs. And they had to feed, you know, at that point it was like a few thousand people max. I mean, the largest campuses were maybe 3,000 to 5,000. Cisco was the largest campus by far, and they had no Asian program for Bon Appetit, right? And Bon Appetit was dominating the industry. So I got sucked up by Bon Appetit to write their first concise Asian training for their cafes. You know, because it's sexier to call them cafes and cafeterias, right?
Sounds so much better.
It's servery.
Cafe.
I don't know.
Cafeteria.
Exactly. Yeah. So I wrote the first Asian program for Bon Appetit in the early 2002-2003.
So when you say program, you're talking about actual Asian food.
Asian food, Asian
because
menus.
They've got all of these Asian people coming in, yep. And you were like, they got nothing for them. So you've got to write menus and recipes.
Menu recipe cycles. You had to go train the staff. And the problem is you had to scale. Because I understood Asian food for, you know, our family's restaurants were maximum 70 seats. So I understood maybe doing 200 and half covers and making
sure,
sauce 250s, whatever. But now we had to feed 5,000 and 10,000.
And it's not just math, is it? It's not just multiply by.
At all.
Uh-uh.
Now it's saute pans become tilt skillets, become kettles, right? From steam kettles.
Did you have the experience to even do that? Because tilt skillet recipe, I mean, that's not the same, man. I mean, until you've worked tilts and you've worked steam jackets, hard to just say, fine, well, you know.
No, I told my boss, I was like, look, I can cook Asian food all day long, and but I need to understand scale, and I need to understand production. And he's like, no problem. You write the recipes. They partnered me with, to this day, she's still like a mentor and one of my bosses at Compass Group. You know, now they're a Compass Group, but she's still my buff. So it took me about I worked it for a year. So there it goes. It's another accelerated program. So I worked production kitchens through Yahoo, Google, eBay, and Cisco.
Okay, let me ask a question.
Yeah.
You worked hard.
I've worked.
When you first started, you were talking about being on the line.
Yeah.
Fine dining or even kind of medium level dining.
Both.
Did you work hard?
I've always worked
okay,
really hard.
Then why did you say you sometimes feel like a fraud?
Because I never did the 3-year, 5-year cycle in each position.
Oh, because you didn't go to France and do a stage. You didn't.
Yes.
Okay. So what you feel is that sometimes you've got something that you shouldn't have or that other people aren't going to respect. Because obviously you've earned what you've got.
Both, though, I think, AB. I think because, you know, I didn't work my way through every brigade station. You know what I mean?
How many of us really have?
Yeah, you're right.
I mean, I worked in a French kitchen, but I didn't, you know, I was never a saucier.
No, yeah, yeah. I was saucier.
I wasn't a saucier.
You know what I mean?
Come on. But does that still bother you a little bit? Because I'll admit that it bothers me a little.
Does it bother you? Honestly.
Yeah, a little. Until I got to the point where I realized, look, I got what I needed to get do what I do. If I had done that, I wouldn't be doing what I'm doing now because the gravity, the momentum of that life pulls you into being a different person.
Right.
So my thing was, I need to work the line, and I need to work the line hard. I need to work the line in a bunch of places. I need to be lead cook. If I can be Sue, okay, but it's for the experience.
Right.
So that I can talk to other cooks and know what it is to feel like on Saturday night at, you know, 9:45 when, you know, a walk-in 12 top happens and you're on the grill. And I mean, I have that, but do I have years of it and years of it? No.
Yeah.
But I did go to a good culinary school and I got my culinary degree, you know, in a 2-year program that's respected, but sure, I still feel a little, you know, every now and then you're afraid that some other cook's going to be behind you saying, it's not the real thing.
We always
shoemaker
hack, whatever, you know what I mean? We'll always have that, but at the end of the day,
it's a stigma, but it's self-inflicted. I think
it is. I think, you know, I've built up enough credits to that, you know, and again, we have done things that the guys who have gone to France and do their European stages have come back and not done. So, you know, so there you go. What got me to Vegas?
You did this massive program For Bon Appetit.
For about 3 years.
For 3 years.
Yeah, for 3 years. So,
well, I could see how the scale of that could very easily transfer to Vegas size.
Exactly. And also transfer to World Records. It's always this other weird kind of niche that I've developed. I've got like four Guinness and one other kind
of what are your records?
Still holding our world's largest stir fry, 4,010 pounds, one go, which was a direct translation of what I learned at Bon Appetit.
What do you cook a 4,000 pound stir fry in?
You have a 15-foot wok fabricated, quarter inch steel, about. So it really looks more like a paella pan at the end of the day when you go to that big, right? That's what I did, 15 foot. And you sink you do the cinder blocks and you sink about 2 tons of charcoal, right? And then you lay, and then you crane in the stir fry pan, and you basically lay a stir fry down that's just, it's 4,000 pounds.
How do you stir a stir fry that's 4,000 pounds?
Really large industrial, these shovels that they, these stainless steel shovels that they make, and these rakes, you know what I mean? You get really big guys from New England to do it, because I've done all my, a lot of my stuff at UMass Amherst, because I'm really good buddies with those guys, and they have the infrastructure, and they can find the funding.
What made you all of a sudden one day decide I'm gonna do record food? I mean, I'm gonna do record breaking food.
You know, it was kind of to me like a no brainer. So Compass acquires Bon Appetit,
right?
In the first, you know how they do this annual, you know, let me show you how big. But anyway, this is annual like multi sector thing in Charlotte. Charlotte Shout, right? And
I've been to Charlotte.
You've been to Charlotte.
I've performed
Shout.
In Charlotte.
Exactly. Yeah. So it was our come out year. We were one of the smallest companies that Compass acquired. We wanted to come out big. So my boss at Bon Appetit is like, we got to do something huge. I'm like, literally, then let's do a world record. We're gonna break the record for the world's largest stir fry. And he's like, if you think you can do it, I mean, I said, I need dollars. I need an engineer. And I need a team. That's all I need. And we broke the world record that year.
Was there ever a point where you thought, oh crap, I'm not going to pull this off?
Multiple points. So in between, so it takes months to get the math together, to get the engineers to build the wok. So the initial record at that point was 800 pounds. So I'm thinking I can do 1,200 pounds at that point. About 15 days before go time, South African high school breaks the world record.
So, bastards.
So
bastards.
We're engineered, mise en place, prepped, PR, everything for like 1,200 pounds, and they push it to 15 or something like that. So all of a sudden we had to ramp to 2. And we had to weld on sides, figure out the mise en place, figure out if our heat sources would work. So there was, and then the shipping to the wok to Charlotte, the wok had damaged. So, you know, the whole, it should have been a reality show, because we were out there welding it about, you know, in the middle of the night, 3 hours before go time and all that stuff. So that's how it all started. It was a direct translation to me. Like, you know, when I was at Cisco Systems, they fed like 20,000 people a day at their height.
Right. Right.
And you know, so I was writing menu cycles and production sheets for 20,000 people. So this was no problem. But we never did it. And in my mind, I thought I could do it. We did it, broke it, and then went on to world's largest seafood stew, 6,000 pounds. World's largest fruit salad at 16,000 pounds. World's longest California roll at 440 feet. So we
just, how do you get that much nori to stick together?
Oh, right? Man, that was really hard. So you have to first lay down your maki sous end to end.
Right.
The secret is laying down the nori overlapping by about 1.5 inch. So when you start to roll, it starts to pick up the other end. So yep. Like a tidal wave.
Yep.
But you have to keep that thing moving or it snaps.
Snaps.
So it took about 3 hours to roll 440 feet of California roll. So, and you know, you're playing with time and temperature, because to get a certified record, it has to be edible.
Yep.
So it was 4 hours. We did in 3 and 3.5.
Would you do in a refrigerated warehouse or something? How did you deal with that?
Well, we couldn't. So once everything came out of, you know, either cold or ultra hot, we had 4 hours to go, period. Because
you got to get it out of the zone.
Yeah. And you can't find a refrigerated warehouse that's got a straight line at 440 feet.
No, that's long.
Yeah, it's really, really long. So there you go. Sorry, there's a long answer to get to Vegas.
No. So that happens. Now close the gap to Vegas.
Yeah, there you go. So fine dining, production cooking, you know, running P&Ls for both. And then now I was 32 and I got a phone call. And you might know Elizabeth Blau, who was the director of when he did Bellagio, she brought all the chefs in, right? So Elizabeth calls me and says, you know, Jet, we can't find a chef for Encore, right? We've done six tastings from guys from around the world, and there's guys that you and I know really well that have cooked the tastings for this, and they can't find the blend of Thai, Chinese, and Japanese, because Steve's vision for Encore was, I need one restaurant, not four like the other tower has. I want one restaurant that does all three cuisines really well, plus in-room dining, plus the Sky Casinos, plus the sushi program. And like no one could do all those cuisines. So, I was a nobody. I literally was a nobody at that point, you know. And Elizabeth says, look, we're desperate. Will you come cook a tasting? And I need to come in. So, you know, I'm thinking to myself, I thought the whole entire time, it's kind of, I'm going to go through this for the exercise, right? I'm going to go in, I'm going to cook a tasting, they're going
to
say,
because I need to do it.
And I think just the tasting at Wynn would take me to that next level. So 2 days, right? I did one entire day of mise en place. I did my prep, and then I did 9 courses, all Pan-Asian, right? There was no repeats in those 9 courses. Maybe one or two repeats in ethnicity. So second day, I'm wearing jeans and I'm wearing like a Bon Appetit coat at that point, thinking this is going to be a fun exercise. I'm going to get the hell out of here. I got a room at Wynn for 2 days. I'll party that night and I'll go home the next day. So, you know, Steve, the execs, everyone sits down for the meal, you know, and I wasn't nervous. I think that's what really...
Because you didn't have a chance.
I had zero chance.
So why be nervous?
Exactly.
Make connections, be cool, be yourself and get out.
I walked into that group. I was like, I'm Jet Tila. You guys have never heard of me. Short bio. I know lots of different Asian ethnicities, and I hope you guys enjoy your meal. And so in an hour and 15 minutes, I laid down nine courses. Everything.
How much
from
help
sushi,
did you have?
I had one person. I had one assistant. They gave me a chef de
partie. You knocked down 9 courses for how many people?
12 or 14 people. Yeah. Ugh. Tasting. Yeah. Exactly.
I'm sorry, man. That just makes me, that makes my head hurt, dude.
But it was awesome, right? It was awesome. So it was in the Wing Lei dining room, and again, everything from sushi, sashimi, batera. I mean, I did a lot of different technical things to curries, Thai food, and then I did some fusion things like, you know, finger foods like wings. And then I walked out there. Hope you guys enjoyed your meal. And they're like, when's your flight? I'm like, I leave in about 3 hours. They're like, we need you to stay till tomorrow. I was like, is this really?
And that's when you got scared.
You're going to be interviewed by the executive chef of the property. You're going to be interviewed by director of food and beverage, and you're going to hang out for a while. And I was like, dude, seriously, this is crazy. Look, long story short,
but this is the good part. This is the good part, man.
So this is the best way I've ever been interviewed. So this is a really smart director of F&B, right?
Uh-huh.
So the dude's like, where do you think you want to live in Vegas? There's really two neighborhoods you want to live in. You want to either live in Summerlin or Henderson.
I'm like,
what are you talking about? What am I going to... You know what I mean? She's like, no, we're going to go for a drive. I'm going to show you Henderson and Summerlin. So he has you captive in a car for 1.5 hours so you could pick your brain. That was a genius move. That was not an office setting.
We're just going to go cruise around. We're going to supposedly be doing one thing while we're actually doing another thing.
So at the end of the day, you know, executive chef interview, food and beverage, and then... that night, they said, why don't you have dinner at one of our casual Asian restaurants so you can get a feel of the property. One top myself, it's about 9 p.m. because I've just been through the ringer. Tasting, executive chef interview was pretty simple. That was no big deal because the guy was, he was a suit, end of the day, right? He wore his cleanest coat, never had a stain on it. One of those guys, right? Counts beans for a living. And then
food costs, labor costs.
Yeah, that's it. And then I sit down. About to relax, about to breathe for the first time. Call my mom, call my girlfriend. Hey, yo, this might be happening. And the COO takes that opportunity and sits next to me. Like, these guys are really clever. I've learned, you know what I mean? This was like the PhD.
This was all worked out. It's a plan. It looks casual.
It's kind of
genius,
isn't it?
It looks accidental, but it isn't.
If you think about it,
yeah,
every
slick.
Step, it's
very slick,
really,
man.
Really slick. So CEO sits down, just like you and I are sitting here today, and he's like, look, I don't want to screw around. I don't want to beat around the bush. We've tasted like 6-7 guys already, right, from around the world, and we really like your stuff, okay? I'm just going to ask you straight up, can you do this or not? I really admire that, because I think in interviews, people beat around the bush too much. Well, what's your theory on
can you do the job or can't you do the job?
That's it. Yeah. How do you do discipline? What do you think about food costs? How do you manage this?
So the dude looks at you and says, can you do this?
And I said, absolutely. I said,
was there a hesitation?
And in my mind, I'm like, I've never run a $7 million build out. I don't know how to do that. You know what I mean? But I'm thinking, I know food.
But did you think for a moment you couldn't? Or did you always know you could? Or was it one of those, yes, I can, and then go back to your room and change your pants?
I think it was all the above, but I understood all the multiple operations from different... I understood multiple types of operations. I understand P&Ls. I understand labor. I just never had to run one on my own, be the top guy. So, but I was like, I absolutely can do this because I know I can do it. And so he's like, this is the fun part about this interview, right? What's your magic number? Straight up. What's it going to take for you to move to Vegas in the next 45 days and do this thing? And,
did you already have that number? Did you know?
I had no idea.
You hadn't even given it a thought,
man. How would we know this? This was all, you know, constructed to keep me off balance all day, get into my head, figure me out, and then go in for the kill.
Yep.
He went in for the kill. So I slide the piece of paper. So I was thinking, what did I make these last 3 years? I'm thinking to myself, what was my year of year? What was the best year I had in the last 3 years? Double that and hope for the best, right? And then I slide the piece of paper across, and he looks at it. And he didn't flinch.
No, of course he doesn't.
I screwed
up. Stone cold killer, man. And you did screw up because you didn't triple it.
Exactly right.
You lowballed, Jet.
I totally lowballed.
And you knew it. You knew it the second you saw his face, didn't you?
I was waiting for the eyeballs to go, wow. I was waiting for like an eyebrow.
Nothing.
I was waiting for eyes.
Statue.
This is what he said to me. I'll see you tomorrow morning in my office with a contract for you to review. I screwed up. I should have tripled that number and walked away. So that started my 4-year win adventure.
And now Vegas.
Mm-hmm. Garnered a lot of awards. Did all the Asian dining at Encore. Everything from, again, in-room to fine to right. The Sky Casinos. Did all of Steve's Sushi at that time. I kind of revamped the sushi program for both towers.
Nope. What did you know about sushi? Are you learning the whole time? Are you like running home at night and reading every book you can? Did you really know sushi that well?
You know, I got to tell you, that's when I channeled my inner Alton Brown, because I spent the 10 years previous to that reading books about sushi, studying under a sushi guy.
So you had done the work.
I've done the work. And I also went to, there was a school in LA at that time that was ran by hardcore, like they knew the need. The need was chefs. Non-Japanese chefs wanting to be sushi chefs, so they created a really great program because you couldn't get it if you weren't Asian at that time.
No, in fact, when I was going for my second internship at culinary school, mm-hmm. I tried to do a sushi internship, and I couldn't find anybody to take me because I didn't speak Japanese.
Right.
And speak Japanese. It wasn't that I was gaijin. It was just that I did.
Because if you
speak
spoke Japanese, you'd been fine.
Yeah.
Right?
I could have gotten by, but I got nothing.
Yeah. So, what... So Good Eats, right? How many seasons?
We didn't even count by season. We just counted by years.
Episodes.
We did 252 episodes over 14 years.
Did you have a break at all?
No. Because never.
Okay. The food, it was an instant, one of the food networks, like it was an instant hit, right? It took immediately.
Well, you know, it did find an audience immediately. It was the first show that had been... commissioned to the outside world. Food Network had done everything in-house.
Well, that was
was the first show that they had hired somebody. That's what they've told me. It was the first, you know, outside production. And we premiered on Wednesday nights at 9. And then there was a repeat at 11. And I think we also had Saturday night at 9 and something else. And the show... You know, back then, the metric was tough because there was no social.
Right.
So, you know, all you're doing is looking at actual, you know, ratings, and then you're looking at emails and stuff like that were coming in. So all I knew is that we'd get renewed. You know, we got at that time we were working in 13 show cycles. So I didn't think it was going to happen. I had made the shows and they had just laid there. Nobody at Food Network would even watch them for a year. Finally, an executive actually saw a piece of it online at Eastman Kodak had put some of it online because we had used a new film process. Boring story. But when they finally did order it, I just didn't think it was going to happen. I thought the deal was going to fall through. So I hadn't written scripts because my whole thing was it was going to be a completely scripted show. Completely.
Really?
Every single word, which it was, all 252
You're
episodes.
Kidding.
Completely scripted. And so I hadn't written them. And so when the trigger got pulled, I had 3 months. No, 2 months. To research, recipe test, and write these 13 like, episodes. Yeah. And it was literally for the next 14 years, it never stopped. Because we would generate anywhere from 300 to 500 pages of research per show.
Wow. See, that's what I want to know, going into 300 to 500 pages of research only.
Notebooks of research, just because everything would come from the research. The storylines came from the research. Of course, the dishes came from the research.
Yeah.
And at first, I was testing all the recipes by myself.
Wow. And this is pre-internet, kind of. I mean, it wasn't as user-friendly as it was today.
No.
That's what I mean.
Oh gosh, no.
It was super clumsy.
No. I spent a lot of time in libraries.
Right. Oxford Food Guides, old school recipe books.
And magazines, you know. I knew that that it would work, though, because I knew that this little bitty kind of silly-looking magazine called Cooks Illustrated was catching on.
Mm-hmm.
And they were big into know-how. So I thought, this is going to be okay if I can just keep on top of the workload.
Right.
Which, on a day-to-day basis, turned out to be probably a little more than I should have done. But then I'm a control freak. So by the time the fifth season came around, I was directing the show, producing the show, hosting the show, writing the show, and was overseeing the editing of the show. And so
So you were immersed for 15 years, basically.
Immersed.
I mean, completely immersed.
It was me and I was it.
Wow.
I was Dr. Frankenstein. It was my monster. And sometimes I was the monster, and it ran me. And then actually the nicest thing that happened, though, is after a few years, I think in the fifth season or sixth season, Iron Chef America came along.
Mm.
And I was offered that job of the commentator, and I think that kind of saved my life.
Did you hesitate, or did you kind of know that this was a good job?
I knew that it was something that I didn't know how to do, and that was the thing that I was most interested in. It was like, look, this is like sports commentating,
right?
And I don't know this job at all, but what I like about the job is that it's unscripted.
Mm-hmm.
There's nothing, so I can try to make this work with my skill set, but I'll learn a lot. I'll learn a huge amount, and so I treated it like, an 8-year culinary school,
So that run was 8 years.
I think it's still running.
Yeah.
But the nice thing about it is it was a short burn. We would go in for a month or like a few weeks, and we do two of them a day.
Yeah. It wasn't like good.
You've been there. No. It took me 3 days to make, one episode.
One episode.
I was lucky, but we would crank out, in that amount of time, 6 Iron Chef Americas. You saw the machine.
Well,
it was gigantic.
Today, I can't figure out how you guys get the chefs, the culinary, the commentators, the judges to do two shows a day. I mean, that's efficiency.
System.
Like, perfect.
It is a system. Triage Entertainment, Food Network, Culinary, which is just the best.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody knew exactly what to do, and they built it out as a machine. And, every now and then something would happen. But, very, very rarely. We were very fortunate. Nobody ever lopped an arm off or, somebody that made us stop.
Right.
The clock never stopped on a battle, ever, that I can remember.
So you got Good Eats right into Next Food Network Star.
Yeah, actually, and Feasting on Asphalt, my motorcycle.
Which is a brilliant series, by the way.
Which was also pre-GoPro,
wasn't it?
Oh, gosh,
imagine how that would have changed
GoPros,
that show.
Oh, my gosh. I could have made 15 more in the same amount of time if I'd had GoPros. Mounting regular video cameras on motorcycles. Oh, my gosh.
I don't know how you did it, man.
And the cool thing is, like, GoPros, one of them falls off, you just let it go. You don't go back. Oh, no, it was so hard.
So I'm thinking, like, I've gotten to work with one of my idols, Alan Brown. I'm thinking the GoPro would have changed that show.
Yes.
Completely.
Probably would have kept going.
Yeah.
But it was just too difficult.
Okay. How many seasons? GoPros. 2, 3?
Well, we actually did 3.
Yeah.
One was only 4 episodes. One was, it's funny that I can't remember this anymore, I think 6 episodes. And then we took it to the Caribbean and did Feasting on Waves,
mm-hmm.
which was a terrible mistake. Horrible mistake for 2 reasons. One, boats don't always go where you want them to go. Sailboats don't always go where you want them to go. And number 2, down in the Caribbean, here in America, you get out a camera,
mm-hmm.
people flock.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody wants to be on TV. Down in the Caribbean, man, it's the opposite. They think you're going to take something from them. They think you're going to play them. So you've got to spend where I used to could walk into a place and do a segment and be out in an hour.
Yeah.
In the Caribbean, I got to go in and invest 4 hours just to get them to trust me enough to know that I'm serious and that I'm going to respect them.
Yeah. Good to know.
Which was personally wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
Horrible for making a TV show because
not
your time.
Efficient.
No, it isn't. But, the relationships that you form, even if it's only going to be over a meal or two, are actually genuine
that
relationships, which are almost impossible to have in America. Feasting on Asphalt was 100% documentary. We did not pre-plan anything. We'd get up in the morning and say, okay, we're going that way.
You caught that all no pre-pro.
No pre-pro. Nothing. We had no idea where we were going. Well, the first one, we only knew we were going cross-country.
Yeah.
The second one, we knew we were going up the Mississippi River.
That's amazing.
That's all we ever knew.
Look, we just started jet fueling. I have nothing.
Which, by the way, I think is... awesome title.
The title's great, but we have no tech.
So fantastic. I hate you for being able to do that.
We have no tech. God, and like, I think we've made like a dollar already. Look at it. We have like one thousandth of your viewers. I appreciate you letting me interview you too, though, because
happy to do
you know.
Well, all right, here's an interview
question. Yeah, go.
When's the book?
In my mind, right, again, I don't feel like we have enough of an audience for a book yet. That's how I feel. I don't think people know enough. And, about me to even care about buying a book, right? And then
that doesn't mean you shouldn't be writing it.
That's true. So is that true? Like,
yes.
You should be locked and loaded? Is that what you're saying?
Yes. You know why? Because books are so long lead, man. You don't want to end up in a position where somebody says, we need a Jet Teela book for 2015. You got 8 weeks to write it.
Well, yeah, you're right.
Well, I only say it because that's what happened to me on my very first book. So I found a publisher who would let me do a book that had nothing to do with Good Eats.
Got it.
And okay. It was called I'm Just Here for the Food. And what I decided was to do a book about heat.
Yeah.
And base it on cooking methods. And I found a publisher, Stuart Taborian Chang, that was happy to have me do that. And so I sat down in an Airstream trailer, a 1984 Airstream Ambassador, and wrote that book in 8 weeks.
Wow. You really had 8 weeks to write a book.
I wrote the first pass in 8 weeks.
That's nuts. Okay. So after
today.
So
don't let this happen to you.
So we have a proposal and a writer already. So, I mean, that I can work with to crank one out. So, all right, I've just been inspired to get this done. You know what I mean?
You know what? I think that by the time you think that you've finally got your audience, you're going to want to be ready a lot faster.
Okay. So
and you've got a lot to say.
Is it broadly Asian? Is it what? I mean, I don't even know where my voice is, man. I really don't, because I've done too many different things.
Okay, that's if there's a problem, that's it.
Yeah.
You have to know what your voice is and what your angle is. I still think that no one, has cracked Asian food for white people.
Yes.
We're still scared to death of it.
Yes.
We still don't know how to even shop it.
And my
still,
people aren't helping in that, right? Because the markets are funky and they have that funky smell.
There's
got to
be.
Stuff.
Well, I think that, you know, white guys, you know, I mean, I love Asian markets.
Yeah, yeah.
But then I'm not afraid of asking questions and stuff like that. But no one has really crossed that yet.
Yeah.
You know, no one has been able to do that. And I keep looking for it. You know, I keep looking for who is going to finally take. And I would say Pan-Asian because the truth is I want to know how to make pad thai as much as I want to make a satay or as much as I want to make a decent, you know, coconut soup or whatever it is.
Mm-hmm.
But no one's crossed that line. No one has made that guide.
So that is one of the concepts on the board. I think that's the very simple way. But again, we have to try to keep it from being a tome as well, right? Because you have to teach people how to shop. You have to teach people what the ingredients are. And then you have to teach them how to cook it. So you validated one of the concepts.
So you know
anyway.
What? So what? Okay. Say you're going to shop and cook people through 100 recipes.
Mm-hmm.
Just 100.
Yeah.
Pick 100. You know, most publishers will tell you, I think it's to really be on a cookbook shelf in a store. Not that there are that many of those left, you know, a cookbook that you've got to have. I think it's like 80 something recipes.
Yeah,
or something.
Yeah, yeah.
So I would pick the smallest amount.
Perfect.
And then shop it. Pantry it, you know, help them build an Asian pantry.
Yeah,
help them know how to buy fresh Asian stuff. How to even talk to people in the market.
That's an awesome way.
Yeah. Because every town in America now has got an Asian market.
100%. And with the internet, it's changed the way.
Oh, because you can get so much on the internet.
You don't have to go to the Asian market anymore, which is the cool thing. And people are apt to do that. You know what I mean?
I mean, there are people I know. I would just still like to be able to make a decent pho, for God's sakes. You know,
and again, I can teach people to do that either with a base or bone. So I think that's the way to go.
There's your book.
There it is.
I'm in line.
Will you write the little like quote thing?
I'll do the forward.
Yeah, there you go.
That'd be awesome. Or at least a blurb on the back.
A blurb would be plenty, man.
But you need to do that.
Okay.
And you might find that it gives you direction. You know, in your life, in a way to know what's next and what ought to be coming down the pipe for you.
I think so. I think you're absolutely right. You know, so this whole TV thing has been definitely a new.
What was your first TV experience of the culinary media world?
I think it was 2000. I think it was 1999. The Best Of. Remember that show?
Sure, of course.
Yeah, The Best Of Holiday Gifts. I was the first dude to ever create a Thai web store. So I put a wok, I put fish sauce and dried shrimp. It was a dumb idea after the fact because when it broke, It was just a mess. Like, it was really gross. But I made the first Pad Thai cooking kit. It was like 1999. And then really rudimentary shopping cart system, because there weren't really processing online yet.
Sure.
You came to the BangkokMarket.com because it was the first grocery store. It had to be the first, web store. And bought pad thai or tom yum or something, or tom, like, coconut soup. And I sent you everything you needed with the recipe, except for fresh items.
Sure.
And then, that show did this, best of holiday gifts. So that was the first time I was ever on TV.
I remember best of. Because sure. 99 was my first year on the network. So I remember it well.
Yeah. Wow. And my episode, I was the guy who came on after me in the segment after me was Andrew Zimmern. And I forgot he was selling at that time, but we were all very different then. So
a lot of water under the bridge. So
yeah.
How did that become what you're doing now? Because I mean, the whole reason we're even having this conversation is because you're one of the three judges on Cutthroat Kitchen.
Yeah. So, always was tapped by, you have these pivotal influences in your life. You know, this guy's named Barry Gribben, and he did, a few different shows on Food Network. And then he did a lot of script shows, and he would put me on these TV shows all the time, Asian Face talking about Asian food. And it was, and then I did a lot of HGTV guest star, how to cook stuff. And then the pivotal moment was Iron Chef. I mean, after that, it really took off.
How was that experience for you?
That was one of the best cooking days of my life, because I had the best team I've ever worked with. You know what I mean? I had the best sushi chef I've ever gotten, I've ever worked with. I had the best Thai sous chef I ever had. And we battled Morimoto and battled seaweed. I mean, it was a really tough deal, and we trained like mad, and it was a close battle. I mean, it would have been awesome to win, but it was one of the best cooking days of my life. I mean, cooking, we take it seriously, right? It was just awesome to cook across from Morimoto and his two sous chefs, and he's sweating and we're sweating and we're banging it out, and he made some beautiful food. We made some beautiful food. Just to go toe to toe was awesome. It was really awesome. So, Cutthroat, did you ever think that it would be the hit that it is today?
When they came to me about the concept, the Food Network came to me and Embassy Row, the production company, came to me with a concept. This is only a year and a half ago, I guess. Actually, we were shooting Food Network Star, the last Food Network Star, not the one that's getting ready to start, but the last one. The second that I was intrigued, because it was based loosely upon some auction segments we had done on Next Iron Chef.
Oh.
That had been a lot of fun. And in those segments, you were always auctioning time. Like, okay, here's a tuna. And whoever auctions the least amount of time to cook it gets it, kind of thing.
Got it.
Right. And they were a lot of fun. And so I liked the auction, the gameplay of an auction. But I didn't know. I was very skeptical until we did a Not For Air pilot, which we shot at a culinary school in...
Here, right? In L.A. somewhere?
Yeah, Okay. But I can't remember exactly where it was. It wasn't Burbank, but it was...
Pasadena?
May have been.
No?
No, it wasn't Pasadena. It was... I can't remember what part of town it was. But as we were shooting it, I started thinking, and we had no money. It was like culinary students, or I don't even remember who it was. I started realizing, this is fun, and this is different because this is a game. This isn't just another competition where it's, okay, chefs, you've got to take these ingredients, you've got this much time now.
Right.
It was a game. You have to play this game if you're going to win. And so when I realized, oh my gosh, this is a game show, and I coined the term evilicious, because it was like there's a naughty, naughty dark little edge to this fun little blade, and that's when I thought this could be something.
And this is coming from me, and I think I read this a lot. I mean, you really look like you're having a lot of fun with this show.
Sometimes.
I mean, I know it goes back to your theatrical background, but still, like, it's maybe it's this you're showing. You know, different sides of the, I don't know if it's personality or the character or what I mean?
The person that I am on Cutthroat Kitchen is a character.
It's
a lot like me, but that's not actually me. And it's funny, a lot of people, I mean, I did on social get a flack when the show started, because there were people that said, I thought you were a nice guy. And they thought that, we watched Good Eats for years and you were such a nice guy and now you're not. I'm like... And I actually wrote a thing, did a Twitter post one day where, because I use these post-it notes, where I wrote, everybody, it's a character. It's a role. You know, okay, you're not asking Johnny Depp for navigational information because of Captain Jack. Okay, so don't get in my face about being this mean person. It's all in fun.
Yeah.
And I think that as the show has gone on and chefs know what to expect, mm-hmm. they have more fun.
Right, right.
In the beginning, they didn't because they thought we were just screwing with them. But then once word got out and the show got out, people saw how you could have fun with it. And I still yeah. think that you can learn from it. Because yeah. I think the ingenuity that is shown and the solutions that people come up with for the sabotages, you can learn from. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've actually picked up stuff that I've gone home and used, you know, like, oh, well, you know, you can do this instead of this. And, you know, if you use this for your kimchi, you can make kimchi in about half an hour if, you know, you do this. So, I don't know. I mean, you've got a completely different perspective because you're when they first asked you to be a judge, were you like thinking, oh, this is just going to be another competition?
Of course. I'm thinking like, look, everyone's trying to write that next, you know, Chopped, right? Everyone wants to be the next show. And I'm like, you know what? I'm going to do it. And again, what I want to do more TV because I want to learn how to be better at it, right? So these are new muscles for me. Mm-hmm. And I needed to get out of the competing and more into the judging. Like, how do I become an authority, right? How do I start to grow up, graduate? And then as we did it, I'm like, wow, like, and the show has morphed. I mean, it's matured and it's taken on its own personality.
It's gotten bigger and bigger.
But it's so great, though. Yeah. Yeah. So, as a judge, we're so blind. We are so incredibly blind to what's happening. Because, you know, yesterday I got to really sit in and see an episode.
That's the first time you had done that, right? You never, like, sat back and watched one because you're always sequestered.
Yes, exactly. So, it's phenomenal to. We go through, we miss so much, but if we didn't, then I think the show would be a different show. Like, if we were privy to what was happening.
It's critical.
Yeah.
It was one of the things that in the very first pitching of the show, I said the judges cannot know.
You knew then. Like,
oh, yeah.
It would change because the game.
Absolutely. The thing is that nothing makes sense if the judges know the sabotages. It's got to be about the plate.
And you had to trust that the audience figure that out and appreciate it. And it's
yeah.
true.
Well, and you know, the beautiful thing is that you can have a judge such as yourself just completely earnestly telling a chef, you know, this blah, blah, blah doesn't work. And I don't know why you put that on the plate. And the poor chef sitting there going, because I had to put it on the plate,
yeah.
you know. And so there's just a lovely dynamic. If you don't shop right, you know, and people come out with half full baskets. I'm like, grab everything.
Yeah, you're right. Load it up. And certain things are critical, right?
Yeah, but assume that if it's critical, you're probably going to lose it.
Yeah, you're right. Oh, I guess what I mean, there's also things that can always help almost any dish,
oh,
right?
Well,
those kinds of things. Yeah, eggs,
I've said,
flour.
I will never leave a Cutthroat Kitchen pantry without eggs and flour.
There it is. Right, exactly.
At least. And there are probably some other things. You
right.
know, I'd probably always make sure that I had.
Like, sriracha is probably a good one because if you want heat, acid.
But sriracha's yeah. become. I almost rather just make sure I've got heat and acid.
Yeah.
You know? So I'm going to get chilies and lemon or I'm going to get, you know. Sriracha is just, you know, I think just some judges now, you're so used to tasting it.
Yeah.
It's like chili sauce. You're you know, dude, you just mix something in with some chili sauce. I recognize that sweet. You know, what are you trying to do to me? So,
yeah.
or like, you know,
it's become ketchup. I mean,
the
really
death
has.
Knell, which is truffle oil.
Yes. But people still use it continually.
Anytime I see somebody with a bottle of truffle oil, I know they're going home.
Mm-hmm.
They're
and
not
going to
win.
Tell you
they
about
will
their
not
culinary
ever win.
Ability. Like, come on guys. Like seriously, you know,
I think it's a culinary school move.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true. It's like, I haven't really worked in the real world much kind of move.
It's one of those telltale signs. Yeah. I used to think that I could tell who was going to win by examining their knives in the morning, but I only had about an 80% kill rate on that.
So yeah, you and I have looked at on knives. Set over all these episodes, like because in between shots, like we'd be able to, you said, you know, Jed, I can, you know, my new thing right now is looking at people's knives. But let's go back though. I mean, okay. What were you specifically looking for in their knives and what did that say about them?
What I was looking for in knives, here's my thing. I don't want to see sets of knives. You know, it can't look like you pulled them out of a block. Real chefs bring knives for very specific reasons for specific purposes. I want to see a boning knife that I can tell has been. I'm looking for telltale signs of sharpening, of proper sharpening
yeah.
on them. It's like if I see a knife where I can see that part of the belly or part of the blade starting to bow out, I know they're oversteeling and they don't know what they're doing.
Mm.
I don't want to see. Expensive knives are one thing, but it's like a real shit to my mind.
Yeah.
It's like,
of course.
I might bring a chef's knife. That is a pretty expensive blade or, you know, an old Sabatier or Corbin or something like that. But you know what? When it comes to a boning knife, I'm going to have a cut steel Forstner. You know,
all you
I'm
need.
Just, I
yeah.
don't, I'm not anybody brings, you know, you bring a forged serrated knife into a kitchen, like, why?
Right.
You know, we're, grab the Dexter or something. You know, yeah. you don't need that. So I'm looking for knives that are mission oriented.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, okay, if you're going to bring a cleaver, okay, are you bringing an Asian style vegetable cleaver?
Exactly.
Are you bringing a bone cleaver? You know, and it says a lot about your skills. And a lot of, it's funny, a lot of people will not bring in paring knife, which
yes.
I find odd. I always want to have the option of grabbing a paring knife. I don't think I would come into a competition without a paring knife.
This also is an interesting topic. I mean, the paring knife has kind of gone by the wayside.
It has.
As a tool, as a
well,
chef tool.
Well, we don't turn anymore.
Exactly.
We're not turning anything anymore, and we're not doing flutings. We're not doing the kind of that small kind of work. But I gotta tell you, I will still reach for one
right.
For a lot of other cutting. But that just maybe because of my training.
That's what it is. I mean, a churning knife, like bird's beak or whatever, straight, mm-hmm. definitely speaks to someone who's been to culinary school, but actually worked probably like when we went to culinary school, because the new kids don't flute. Like you said, they don't know training. They don't know how to use the detail knife. Or they don't carve. There's no garmage as well. That's also gone by the wayside, I think. You know
so
I mean?
you walk in. I don't remember what knives you brought.
Yeah. Oh, so I'm like, so I would have screwed up. I need three knives in my life. I need one serrated. Mm-hmm. I use a slice, like, you know, an Asian version of a very thin knife for both slicing and filleting. So I can, you know what I mean?
Like an actual sushi. Is it beveled on one side?
Actually, it doesn't even have to be like a vegetable prep knife.
Okay.
So it doesn't even need to be a sashimi knife at all. So I can get away with like, you know, nice, a thin slicer is fine with me. I need a chef's knife, and I need a
Do you prefer a French style chef's knife or an Asian style?
I can work like either, and I also can work the bone cleaver for just about every job as well. Just because for me, a knife is a tool. It needs to be heavy enough and it needs to be sharp enough.
Yep.
And after that, I don't care. I mean, it could be a fresh knife, press knife off the market, but as long as it's sharp, I can get through that day. So
sure.
You know, I'm not super knife loyal. So it's proven to be only 80% accurate.
Because all of a sudden, you know, somebody with a pink. blade, you know, or a, you know, Kyocera, you know, a ceramic blade or something will win.
Which
so,
you'd laugh at bringing ceramic blades into the house, you know.
Well,
you would usually
but
laugh.
Well, you say,
it.
You know, if it's sharp, I can get through the day, you know.
You
so
crack,
you can't crack anything.
Yeah, exactly.
You can't. So, but what the reason that I can't get better than an 80% on it is because the gameplay is
there
too
it
important.
Is. Exactly.
Because in the end, a lot of people that are not the best chefs win this game. And the reason for that is that very often, and this is ego,
mm-hmm.
really good chefs will come in here, look around, realize they're the best cook, and think they can cook themselves through the day.
And only maybe 5% of those guys have survived.
Very small.
Exactly.
Because they get firebombed.
Exactly.
They get firebombed with sabotages. They don't spend the money, and then they get frustrated, and then they're out of their zone. And then all of a sudden, somebody who's like been a personal chef for 6 months is walking away with cash.
Well, because then 1 and 2 will always gun for each other, right? Also, I think if you stay out of the way is another way to survive far, but then you got to cook your way out of that. But
well, the best way to get firebombed by sabotage is to have people be afraid of you.
Yes, exactly right. So how do you not project that? I mean, you know what I mean? At the end of the day, yeah. But look, I don't know. But you're right. The best chef usually goes home. Usually goes home.
I think at least 40% of the time the best cook goes home.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because the game, you know, every now and then a chef will also be really good at playing the game
mm-hmm.
and we'll it's one of those things of, I don't have to outrun the bear. I just have to outrun you.
That's smart.
So they'll cook in such a way where they know that they're going to beat the other dishes, but they're not trying to make a statement. They're not overextending. They're not doing trios and they're not doing.
Yeah.
All that
from a judge's perspective. I mean, all we're really looking for is really the spirit of the dish at hand and not going crazy with it, not either undercooking it, overcooking it, or being too fancy with it, right?
And seasoning.
Yeah, that's it.
Because in the end, like, you're an actual chef. You don't want to send home. You don't want to send somebody home that made good food.
You
that
can.
Made tasty food. So first and foremost, make it taste good.
Right.
Right.
Exactly. No matter what it is,
season
make
it
delicious
and cook it properly.
Mm-hmm. And you're going to get a ton of points. That's half your points, I think, in my opinion. You know. Anyway. God.
Can you see doing? You want to keep doing this?
I would do this until they don't want me to do it anymore.
Yeah, I think I'll do it until they don't want me to do it anymore.
You're pretty happy. You're pretty happy with the show.
I've got to find some balance because, after I still like doing instructional.
Yeah.
You know, and now I'm a game show host. Mm-hmm. I'm a pretty good game show host.
Yeah.
And I'm glad to have that skill. And I think everybody, I can help everybody have a good time on the show, and I can see doing it for a few years. But I got to balance that with other things. You know, I need to do another book. I haven't done a book in 2 years, and I'm still at that point of what am I going to be when I grow up? What I wanted to do at Food Network was show I can work in any genre.
Mm-hmm.
I can work in instructional.
Do you
genre.
Feel confident you've proven that point?
I know that I have skills that are applicable, that I polished. There's some things that I'm as good at as anybody.
Mm-hmm.
And that's fine. But you know what? Then what? You know, I want to continue to be pushed.
But you've proven yourself in the, I'm going to show you how to do it. Like the
instructional.
Right? Instructional. Yeah. But to another level, though. I mean, you have married all those, you know, your mission statement of Julie Childs.
Yeah.
And Michelle, you've done that.
Monty Python and all that.
Right? So
you, that with
you've entered, you've edutained, you've hosted.
I've hosted, you know.
Multiple. I mean,
doing shows. Basically sports shows like Iron Chef America, and mm-hmm. then reality shows like Next Iron Chef.
Yeah, exactly.
Or Food Network Star.
So there's nothing left in the Food Network genre.
Not unless, actually there is. Oh, there is.
Mm.
The thing I'm going after next.
All right. Well,
but it's a genre that they are not currently in.
Got it.
I'm going for late night.
See, that
is a late night
the
talk
magic.
Variety show.
And everyone's trying, and you could, that's perfect.
That's what I'm after, man.
That's
what I'm after. They don't know it yet. Well, Jed, thanks a lot for being on the show, man. I'm glad we got to do this on a day off instead of lunch, because lunch is always,
you know, and I keep saying it, but man, it's been such a learning experience and a pleasure to be able to work with you, man. Like,
thanks.
And again,
I hope we keep doing it.
I'm trying to find the journey, and like you've make me better, and you make me want to be better at all these things. So you're the blueprint, brother. Thank you so much.
Yeah. Problem is, you know, you're on the journey and you think that you got the journey down, and then all of a sudden one day you look around and you're like, whoa, wait a second. What happened to the journey? Where am I?
Do you ever smell the roses?
I tend to, sure. Do I stop and smell the roses?
Mm.
No, I'm not good at stop.
Does that scare you, though, to stop and smell the roses?
Yeah, I smell them occasionally, but it doesn't always mean I know where they are.
Mm.
It's like, what's that? Is that roses?
But you're not present in the moment of smelling the roses.
Not all, very rarely.
If we're getting Buddhist here, you're smelling the roses as you're driving by them.
Yeah.
You're never stopping and really going, I'm here in my shoes and I'm present to all the sounds and the smell, and holy shit, things are pretty fucking awesome.
I have learned, I have started to try to do that, to actually identify, oh, this is a moment. Stop, scan, absorb, have this moment. Because for a very, very long time, everything was a blur.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm at a point now, but the problem, the scary thing about that is that the change in perspective that comes from stop, examine the moment, be in the moment, is that all of a sudden you may find you are not where you thought you were.
Do you have that? Everyone looking in would say you're like the king of this platform, or this thing that everyone wants.
That wouldn't cross my mind for a moment. Mm-hmm. I'm a journeyman, mm-hmm. Worker who is, you know, it's like I refer to myself as a meat puppet, and I do that to keep myself from ever thinking that I'm more or more important. I've seen a lot of people in this business and other businesses become monsters.
Yeah.
Because they buy the PR.
Yeah.
They start thinking they're special. Pretty sure you've got, you know, pretty soon you've got an entourage, mm-hmm. and you're doing this and that. And I'm kind of like, you know what? When a man can't carry his baggage, when you can't carry your own luggage, when you can't stand in line at the airport, when you don't go to the grocery store and stand with everybody else in your freaking sweatpants, you're not really you anymore. And although I may not think I'm the, you know, by any means a fabulous human being by any stretch of imagination, I don't think that I'm forgotten how to be humble about, I'm really grateful that I have work.
Absolutely true. I can attest to that 100% working with you.
Yeah. And I sense you're the same way. You know, every day, you know, when you get in a car and you're like, wow, I own a car.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. We are present in that
I
moment.
A car.
You
I
and
a
I,
car,
yeah.
And you go to your house and you're
I
like,
I wear my
wow.
shoes. I wear my pants.
Yes.
No one lays them out for me. No one tells me how
nope.
awesome they are.
No. No,
and I go home. And
nobody's kissing.
And our wives and our daughters remind us every day.
Yeah, my daughter's like, Dad, you're not special, you know? And that's the way it goes.
Yeah. Anyway, thanks.
Thanks, man.
Thanks for everything.
All right, so that's all the time we have for the Alton Brown Cast this week. I want to thank Jed Tila, colleague and friend, for being here on the show. And hopefully, dude, you and I will be in Cutthroat Kitchen many, many, many more times.
Such a pleasure, Alton. Thank you so much.
My live touring culinary variety show, The Edible Inevitable Tour, is probably coming to a town near you. To find out, drop by www.altonbrowntour.com and click on shows. We'll see you there.